When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 33.
And it's also got a flight control reset button. Now, my harness is locked, so I'm resetting, and I don't hear tower. I come up, the flight control's reset, much like your control off delete on your computer. And the next thing is the airplane goes knife edge, okay? When it goes knife edge, Wizard punches us out, which means the canopy goes, the airplane pitches 15 degrees, nose over, rolls inverted. He leaves at about 480 feet, hits on his heels and goes back. And by the time I leave, I get shot in the ground from 380 feet with about 80% of the chute. Break my leg, rip off my chin, for the most part, because the mass just took it off. Really hammered, like I said, it was a pretty quick ride and a sudden stop, and I left a hell of a divot.
Altitude.
Tower 26 is released to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Seat tied, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire protect 2.
I'm speed, I'm ready to play. Runway burn around curveballs at 354.
What's that? Viper 01, be advised, the restricted area 6002 is still active.
Turn in, that's on.
Next,
610, 13,000,
targeted
somewhere back. Viper 1 targeted.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Afterburn Podcast. I'm your host, John Waters, call sign Rain, former Air Force F-16 pilot. First and foremost, I'd like to thank all my patron supporters over on Patreon. You guys have all helped the podcast grow, and I appreciate the support. Also, like to thank all of you who've taken the time to go over to iTunes and leave a rating or review, especially those who've taken the extra 3 to 5 seconds, and even just leaving the one word or even a paragraph talking about the podcast. All that helps bring awareness to the show and help it grow. So thank you for those who've gone over to iTunes. And if you haven't, please consider just taking 10, 15 seconds, swing over there and drop a rating and review. Thanks. My guest today is Colonel Doug Smash Yurvich, a Marine. He started off flying the F-4, then transitioned to the F-18. He was a test pilot. He has his PhD. He knows a thing or two about aviation. That opening clip, we were just talking about one of his experiences in the Marine Corps, which is ejecting at 380 feet above the ground, inverted, a spot I argue you don't want to be. But we're going to talk about his career. He's going to share some nuggets of wisdom. So with that being said, let's get into the podcast with Smash.
Well, sir, I appreciate you taking the time to join me on the podcast. Just looking at your resume, it is quite distinguished. You know, you have a PhD behind your title. You're a fighter pilot, a test pilot, and just quite a long and distinguished career. So I'm excited to be able to have you on the podcast and talk to you and just hear about your journey through aviation and life, really, and share some, you know, nuggets of wisdom, because I know you got a few.
Well, great. I really appreciate being offered the opportunity just to talk about flying and how I got here. And I've done a lot of career days for, you know, middle schools, high schools, and colleges on continuing offerings. So, you know, with that, here we are. So,
well, I like to kind of snap back to where it all began. And I know it's probably before this date, but for the official resume, entering the United States Marine Corps in 1975, which I would like to talk about that time frame, because I would imagine you entering the service was different than when I entered the service.
Yeah,
as far as what the sentiment was in the country.
Yeah. you think about it, April 75, the embassy in Saigon was going down, you know, the end of the Vietnam War. They were pushing the helicopters off ships, and it caused some consternation, not so much with mom and dad, you know, and even my high school, I graduated from high school that year, and I talked to the recruiter. So, in fact, I talked to him in April or May. I went to the platoon leaders class, which was kind of a unique program. But anyway, my pantry base date, raise your right hand, was 20 December 75. And I needed a quarter college grades, and I had just completed my first quarter at Ohio State. So when you look at going through your high school graduation and, you know, all that great opportunity, go out and make all you want, you know, there were a good group of people, a lot of guys that I played football and wrestled with and baseball, that went to the Marine Corps and enlisted, went to the Navy and enlisted. A couple went to the Air Force and enlisted, but no one went to the officer accession programs. And, you know, those guys had differing levels and successes of careers. But I think it was the other side, you know, who were you dating? You know, and then, well, you'll get out of the Marine Corps after the first tour, or, you know, when you go to college and maybe grow up, or, you know, you're wasting your life. You know, you could have done a whole lot better. I had a math teacher because I was in honors track in math, and she graduated from that university in Ann Arbor, because we don't say the M word in my house, because I went to Ohio State. And, you know, when the senior class was in calculus, which was the best they could do there at the time, she said, you know, Mr. Yurvich, where are you going to school? And I told her Ohio State, and she said, I'm very disappointed in you. So there were a lot of people kind of had that same sentiment about going in the Marine Corps.
Yeah. The well, what was the drive to go do that? Did you have any family members, or did you just want to go?
My dad was an air policeman in the Air Force for 3 or 4 years. And he spent most of his time in France.
Okay.
You know, guarding, what was it, B-26s.
Okay.
He got out and was a policeman in Northeast Ohio for a while. I had two uncles who were sergeants in the Marine Corps. I think that was what they got to. I don't know how much time or if any they had in Vietnam. I don't think that really affected me as much as, you know, my dad used to take me to Cleveland Hopkins and we'd see airplanes. I had a P-51 Mustang hanging from the top of the bedroom from the lamp, you know, above. I think more importantly, though, I you know, John Glenn was from Ohio, you know, Neil Armstrong was from Ohio, and I thought going to Ohio State, I wrote the ROTC unit, and they welcomed me in, but, you know, I wasn't so sure I wanted to do that. In fact, I was dating a gal, and her older sister was dating another guy who went to a rival high school, and it's Admiral King High School, and he told me about the platoon leaders class. So, you know, in April of 75, I find myself downtown walking into a recruiting station, and the sergeant knew my mom because she worked at the proximity McDonald's. It's not, Lorain, Ohio is not a big town. In fact, since they closed the steel mill, it's shrunk a lot. But, you know, so I'm talking to him. I said, hey, I'd like to go to Cleveland, talk to the officer, selection officer. I want to go in the Marine Corps as an officer. But what I didn't know was the regional district reps were there, and a sergeant major, who I didn't know was a sergeant major, him and a couple other senior individuals come walking out from behind there. And, you know, he's got seven stripes and a star, and I got no idea who he is. So, you know, I was always told growing up, if you go talk to a Marine recruiter, make sure you take a priest and a lawyer. So I didn't, but I prepped, you know. I'd already been accepted to college. But, you know, picture 1975, long blonde hair, you know, just. So anyway, we got to do a little tete-a-tete between me and the sergeant major. And, you know, what makes you think you can go in the Marine Corps? You know, what makes you think you're college material? What makes you think this, this, and this? And he didn't know anything about me, although the sergeant kind of did. He didn't say anything because, of course, this guy was a sergeant major. So finally, after, you know, I think it seems like 15, 20 minutes in history wise, it was probably about 3 to 5, maybe 8. I finally looked at him and did no respect or disrespect. I called him sergeant and I said, "Sergeant, if I'm going in the Marine Corps, I'm going in with bars on my shoulders and not stripes on my arms." So he looks at the sergeant. He goes, "He's cocky enough to be a Marine. Send him to Cleveland."
Yeah. So I was to say, I feel like every Marine story is that way. It's like, you can't, you know, someone wants to join, man, you're not good enough to join, right? And then
you got to prove to them. It's the old, if you've ever taken time to look at, I show this every now and then. It's a 1972 recruiting flip by the Navy. It's called Pressure Point.
Okay.
You got to Google it and get the old one. It's candidate Macklin who shows up at Pensacola and goes, you know, the guy down there is at the guard gate, you know, civilian, rolls his eyes. He goes, "Hi, Mac, where do I check in?" And he goes, you know, gives him directions and he rolls his eyes. And he walks up to this drill instructor and he just rips into him. He goes, "What is this? I'm here to fly airplanes. I'm not here for this." So it's the same thing in the Marine Corps. You got to prove. And again, if you look at the advertisements of the services on TV, you can see who they're getting. And the Marine Corps is all about challenging. And at that time, if you remember, one of the posters was, you know, "We don't promise you a rose garden," where the drone instructor's cover is just poking right in the head. And I had that happen at Quantico because I went through officer candidate school in 76 and 78. So, you know, it was exactly what you expect of it, or at least what they advertised at the time. But think about that sergeant major, right? Typically a sergeant major has probably got 25 years in. In 1975, that means he was 1950. Korea, Vietnam. And here's a 75, you know, 18-year-old kid in 75, long blonde hair going, "Hey, Sarge, where do I check in?" Right? So I went to Cleveland and 20 December, I went, ran 1 mile. It was on East 9th and Euclid. It was about 9 degrees out with 20 miles an hour coming off of Lake Erie. So they only made me run 1 mile instead of 3. And I don't know if I was a better runner back then because I was younger, but 5:56 for a mile was probably because I was freezing my butt off. So, you know.
Yeah. Motivated to survive.
Yeah, that's right. My dad was down there. He was freezing, but they let him stay inside. So.
Oh, that's incredible. So you do, you know, the Ohio State University. I know that you got to put the in front of it.
Yeah, that wasn't really that way when I was there that I remember. It's on the alumni watch, but there was some type of lawsuit inside of Ohio because, you know, it's the possessive versus, you know, in Ohio State University, which is any other university, you know.
But yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I got it.
It is what it is. And through that, because Marines do the two, you can do like the one, like, well, I don't know, like 9 week OCS, or you can do the two. It sounds like you did the two.
Yeah. Two 6 week versions. It depends on when you sign in, you know? So if you're a college graduate, you walk in and do that, they're going to send you down there for 10 weeks. You're going to be a direct commission, become a second lieutenant and go right across down to Camp Barrett and go to the basic school, which is 6 months of second lieutenantdom.
Okay.
I signed in from the very beginning, which meant I could go one summer and I could take a break, which I did in 77. In 78, I went for the second summer because then I was graduating in 79. So,
okay. And you're not, and during that time, you're just a college student. You're not doing it. There's no.
Until you do the first increment and then you take money. Because at that time they offered $100 a month and I took it because I was working two jobs and getting 2 degrees. I was so competing weightlifting and I was doing some martial arts activity. I didn't have a car for the first 2 years. So once you took that $100 a month, if you didn't graduate, you were going to Paris Island.
Yeah, gotcha. The old contract.
There's another motivation, right?
Yeah.
You know, the PLC program has three subsets, PLC air, PLC ground, and PLC law. So, you know, you're not playing in PLC law until you graduate and you get accepted by law school. But you're either a ground officer, which we all start that way. But if you're PLC air, you pass the AQT FAR at the time and you maintain your physical capability, once you got done with the basic school, which was 6 months in Quantico, then you would go to flight school. But there was a delay during that time frame too. So I went to FAC school in Little Creek, and then I went to 2nd Marine Division at Camp Lejeune as a second lieutenant, trained forward air controller to wait for my turn to get to flight school.
So you commissioned, became a forward air controller, and then went embedded with a unit and waited?
Yep.
How long until you, from when you graduated to when you started flight school?
13 months.
Okay. Yeah. See, so yeah, I mean, the Marines.
Basic school is roughly 6 months, and then there was a 6 month delay.
Okay. And that's one thing I didn't realize. And when I was at Kandahar, I worked a good bit with some Marine KC-130 guys, most of which were Hornet drivers by trade. And then they kind of rotated through to do the KC-130 because they had a bunch of Hellfire and Griffin missiles on it. And yeah, I was watching on several documentaries at the time, all of which these guys were all in it as forward air controllers during, I guess they're usually like their second assignment,
correct
me if wrong, but they do a Hornet, a jet assignment, then go be a forward air controller. And these guys are, you know, in Helmand Province calling in airstrikes.
Now, you should be a captain by the time you're really an operational fact with the way the Marine Corps had it. But in essence, they were stuffing second lieutenants all over the Marine Corps. And about six of us went to FAC school. A whole bunch went to state of Quantico. Some went to Pax River and got to fly a little bit. So that helped me, quote unquote, later, because my first Westpac deployment to Iwakuni, before I even landed, I was reassigned to 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines at Camp Fuji, and spent that whole first Westpac as a FAC doing Team Spirit 84. Camp Fuji, down to Okinawa at, where were they at? They were up north at, by 2nd Recon. They had some nice real estate north side of Okinawa. But so I spent most of my first 6 month deployment in an F4 squadron in the 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines, as we would like to say, in another aviation appreciation tour.
Marines have a few of those. So you go pilot training. You get an F4 out of it, and then your first F4 assignment, you go and doing.
There's a little bit of lag in there. I go to Pensacola, then I get jets. I go to Beeville, Texas, and go through T2s and A4s. You know, and you got to go to the ship twice.
Okay.
So, I flew the T-28 in primary, and then did reasonably well. Although it didn't start out that way. That's the first airplane I ever flew. And got to flight school, went through Beeville really rapidly. The T2s and A4s were good. Ship was okay. I mean, I passed, you know. And the senior Marine there, who I still know, he's around here, who pinned my wings on me. You know, anyway, I was asking for Harriers, so I went to Harriers. So I went to Cherry Point and flew the Harrier in the rag for a while, and I was about done. And I was discontinued. Now, there's a lot more to that story than that, but I had two more hops to go, and I would have probably gone to Yuma to a Harrier squadron. So they sent me to a HAMS unit, headquarters of maintenance, and I flew OA-4 Mikes. And I flew that with the group staff, which was, you know, the Marine squadron, and then you have a group, and then you have a wing. So I flew the wing staff. And the group staff, I was a first lieutenant. I was writing a flight schedule. You know, I was doing all first lieutenant stuff. And, you know, I never got asked. I never went to a board. I never talked to anybody. Next thing I know, I had orders to Phantoms and Yuma. But I do remember checking in with the CO and the XO. Both were A4 pilots, Vietnam vets. And Blue Chip Ashworth was the CO. And I reported to him, and he looked at me and he said, your morale's probably down around your ankles right now. I'm going to ask you to do one thing, and that's be a first lieutenant in the United States Marine Corps. And that's what I did. And I think somebody made an assessment on me after that. I left HAMS. I flew there in April of May of 82, checked out, went to Yuma. And started flying the Phantom in late 82 and finished in early 83. Then I went to Beaufort.
Yeah, so you, I mean, roughly about 4 years from the time you graduate to getting checked out in the Phantom. That sound about right?
Yeah, that's about right. I hit my gun squadron in Beaufort in March of 1983. The training squadron was flying F-4Js, which were stiff wing, leaning edge stiff wing. We had F-4Ss in Beaufort in the squadron I went to, which they had leading edge slats. So I turned a little bit better, but it was still a barn door.
So you have a unique perspective. Yeah, long distinguished career in the United States military and the Marine Corps. But you were coming into the military and with a bunch of seasoned Vietnam guys, I would imagine. And then on your retirement, you're on the way out with what the only thing I really know is, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, and in Syria to a certain extent there. So completely different coming in, being involved in the Cold World to counterterrorism operations, which are predominant for forces. Yeah. What was it like being a young guy there, like in the beginning with all these seasoned Vietnam guys?
It was, it's tough to characterize. There was a lot of disturbance and hate and discontent. You know, I was in Northeast Ohio in high school when Kent State happened.
Okay.
There were riots at Ohio State. You see a lot of unrest. 1968, I have a book that says that the year the dream died. Those were difficult years just growing up. So now, you know, I'm a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. We got some internal manpower issues. You know, we got folks that are on the way out and they know it. We had over-recruited. We had big manpower going through the Marine Corps. So people had to leave, you know. The ones who stayed in the Corps were, you know, they were still in uniform. Now, there was, I didn't see a lot of that because I was a new second lieutenant. And I remember hearing lieutenant colonels and colonels and just sitting around, you know, because you're not really allowed to talk to those guys at the time. There were some good mentors, but
yeah.
It was a hard time. Just looking back on it, we did have some racial issues inside of a squadron. But I think that was society wide, you know, to be honest with you. They always say that the Department of Defense is a reflection of American society for the most part. But we churned through that, and really after, you know, 75, and I'm not going to get into political aspect a lot of this, but, you know, we were really a hollow force coming out of Vietnam trying to get ourselves together, and a lot of things weren't really good in the early 80s. And we didn't do a whole lot. We did normal deployments, and we did all that. And I know the Navy kept their carriers moving out because I knew a lot of guys who did that. But there was the typical pendulum swing in manpower and financials and budgets that caused, you know, and you've read a lot of the stuff I sent you, I believe. But, you know, I mean, I went through like three war colleges and study a lot of that. And the pendulum has a tendency to swing. And the force, after being fully exercised, has a tendency to hollow out. And we were kind of there. So, I mean, who spoke at my college graduation? Wally Mondale. And, you know, he just passed. So, you know, and I couldn't wear my uniform and graduate.
Interesting.
Okay? I had to wear a cap and gown and fit in with everybody else in the stadium. Now, my freshman class had 11,000 people, and of that, 5,300 of us graduated at that graduation in June of 79.
Okay.
You know, so, yeah, there was some disdain for the military, of course.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear those stories because, you know, nowadays we're fortunate that it's the polar opposite.
Yeah, the pendulum has swung, and there was a lot to do with, you know, the invasion, 91, and then 9/11. You know, I was in the building at 9/11 at 4E-482. But you can also see the pendulum swinging again.
Yeah. It's always moving, right?
Yeah. Anything about organizational management is you realize the only thing consistent with organizations is change.
Yeah. 100%. And here we go again, right? But yep.
Well, enough of that. Yours has changed during the time you were in, and mine surely did, plus the Navy. And I got like 15 years of my time has been in naval commands and almost 2.5 years at sea. So
that's a lot of time on the boat. We'll get to that because, again, that's another interesting piece. The fact, first Marine to command a carrier wing, correct?
Yeah, that was even on purpose. They got admirals and generals together and picked me. There were two other ones. Tail Hook did a big, nice article when that first happened. And there were two other Marines who, by default or lack of the return of the leadership, took over until the Navy could fill them in. But in this case, there was a board on the 2nd of December, 2002, that met with Marine generals and one Navy admiral for sure that I knew. I think there was another one there, and I won the lottery. Yeah. I had a guy one time when I got picked to be test pilot tell me, you know, they're going to tell you how great you are. They're going to tell you you're handpicked, but just remember, they handpick strawberries and boogers, and you don't look like a strawberry to me. So you always got to wonder. You never read your own, never write, read, or believe your own press clippings. How's that?
Yeah, I buy that 100%. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. Well, it looks like your first really probably round in the Navy was that going through Top Gun?
Yeah, outside of Naval Flight School, because, I mean, we, you know, Pensacola and Beeville were naval air stations, and then the Lexington is a naval ship. But in the transition coming off that first part of a FAC tour and getting back to the squadron, I had one more Westpac deployment to do, and I can remember the CO, the XO was going to take over the squadron, and he was asking all the folks that were staying, what do you want to do in the turnaround? And I told him I wanted to be the pilot training officer. He said, well, you don't have any of the quals. And I said, Skipper, you can fix that. So I had to do air combat tactics instructor and get evaluated by MOTS. That was in Beaufort. And then I went to Top Gun 285. And that was in January, February. Went back to Beaufort for about a week and then went to WTI 285 in Yuma. And that was all in the F4.
Because so you go through Top Gun as a F4 guy, but you shortly thereafter transitioned to the Hornet.
Yeah, so I was on the schools list. Again, this is another one of those, hey, the telephone rang, or they call you in and say, we're making a decision on you, you know. So I was on the schools list to leave Beaufort after that second Westpac, and I was supposed to come up here to Quantico and go to Captain's College. Back then it was Amphibious Warfare School. But now they call it expeditionary warfare. But it's basically your captain's PME now.
Okay.
I had done that by the mail-in books. At that time, right. they were green books. So that was already a check in the box. But so the headquarters calls me and says, hey, we need an F-4 WTI to go out to Lemoore and be a Hornet instructor and be on the F-18D Hornet introduction team. And the task of that team for 2 years was to develop the crew coordination and the syllabus for the F-18D, all right? Its own entity. I mean, so there was a conglomeration of everybody from all activities, type model series in the Marine Corps that were fixed wing for the most part. We had EA-6B guys. We had A6A, pilots that were transitioning the Hornet. We had BNs. We also had an Air Force back seat F-4. And the two guys that I flew ACTI and Top Gun with were both 1980 graduates of the Naval Academy.
And, okay.
They were the reels I did. You know, we did a lot of work with. So, but then Hornets, you're training people. So I was out there for 3 years, 2 years. It was kind of a, you know, you got a lot of responsibilities. You've been deployed. You're now an instructor. We were doing the F-18D work. The biggest problem we had to do was get the cockpits decoupled because they wanted the same thing that was seen in the front to be seen in the back. And in essence, you took an airplane that should be a crew-served weapon and you turn it into a single-seat Hornet, and the guy in the back just basically picks up all the task shed from the guy in the front because he can't do anything. you know.
Who was driving the fact that they didn't want to decouple or wasn't decoupled in the beginning?
Well, that was the initial budget and the layout. Now, there was a big battle between the Navy and the Marine Corps because, I mean, we used to say this, we got thrown off of Naval Air Station Lemoore on more than one occasion by a couple admirals in the Navy because they didn't want anything to do with multi-seat airplane. You know, the A-7s and the A-4s came to F-18s and, you know, single seat was the way of life, right? So
yeah,
the D was kind of, what are you guys doing? Now, years later, it was interesting where they were enamored by the F to replace the Tomcat. And I was at Pax River for a little bit of that. So, and I was also in the building with that discussion. So, you know, there's, it's kind of an interesting turnaround, you know?
Yeah. Again, pendulum, right? There's the thing that's always moving, always changing. Yeah.
But a lot of it was money, you know, the software integration and the money with respect to how you wanted to do that. They had the same discussion initially with the F that they didn't want to decouple them or they didn't want to put the guy in the back and goggles, you know, at night and everything, you know, they finally kind of collectively, everybody, it's a crew serve weapon. If you're going to put two people in, you got to maximize the brain housing groups you got inside those cockpits, right?
Yeah.
So you train yourself combat crew, you got to be able to make sure they employ. You know, the difference really between the F-4 backseat guy who was a great radar runner, you know, the A-6BNs, if I remember right, had some weapons release authority. The F-4 backseaters did not. So even that, you had kind of a little bit of, and then you also have some reverse sensing inside of how they did the control sticks from what a BN liked and what an F4 Rio liked. So, you know, you had to wrestle through all that implementation.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear that because obviously this was not the first time to have someone in the backseat of a fighter. So you think that'd be a lesson learned. I haven't talked to many of my Strike Eagle brethren, but again, I mean, that was developed. Someone figured out that was a crew resource requirement of 1 point, whatever.
Yeah.
So they built around that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. You've been on deployment. I've been on deployment. We always do after action reports, right? In fact, sometimes you do a mid deployment to help the next one coming over. They always are smarter than the guys who are out there. So we know how to do that. So it's only a lesson learned if you learned it.
Touche. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, I told you so, right?
Yeah. No, I don't even, you know, it's not even like that. I mean, you have to be able to assimilate it to basically change your organizational processes to say that we learned something. And, you know, we turn over a third of our combat units during rotation. So how do you maintain combat effectiveness? You know, through SOPs, through training, through you know, customs courtesies. You assimilate into the culture and then you learn your trade and your MOS as you go forward or as applied against the threat because of the mission. Okay. So to think that somebody's going to read an after action report and then change the way they operate in training because they know better. It's just like you said, when you say lessons learned, I just tell you, you know, it's only a lesson learned if you learned it.
Right. Yeah. 100%. That's interesting to hear kind of the evolution of bringing that D model onto line. So by the time you finish that assignment,
I took two swings at applying to Pax River and I got picked on the third look. Otherwise I had helped stand up 101 that was in Phantoms and Yuma and moved over to El Toro before the BRAC. And I was slated to go down to El Toro to a BMFA unit.
Okay, yeah. So you get picked up, you go to test pilot school out at Pax River. Mm-hmm. What was kind of the initial foray? How was test pilot school for that year? I imagine it was busy.
You know, Top Gun at the time I did it was the hardest thing I did. Looking back on it. I mean, just the demand, the physical demand. Okay. You were there 6 weeks. You didn't fly the first day. It was lectures all day. And then everything else was fly and get graded, you know. It's a lot like the movie. There's some things that aren't like the movie. In fact, I was there in 85 and the movie came out in 86. So there's a lot of people in there that I recognize. And if you ever saw The Great Santini, That movie was done with two Marine squadrons in Beaufort. Both of them I was in, 312. There's no werewolf. It was a checkerboard squadron. And if you look at the turtlebacks of the Navy airplanes in that first scene, it says VMFA 251. So it was, same type of thing. It was the hardest thing. Test pilot school had three consistent syllabi going, and it was a demand on your time. And it was also, I was the second senior guy in the class. A guy named Mike Foreman was a 79 graduate of the Naval Academy. And I was a 79 graduate of Ohio State. So, and we grew up in Northeast Ohio, and Mike ended up being an astronaut. He's a P3 pilot. Scott Alpin was in that class. He ended up being an astronaut. So we had a few of those, but you had kind of a group dynamic, but you had your academics, and they sent this nice big academic package prior to showing up. So I don't know what your training is, Rain, but I mean, to go to test pilot school, you need to have a math degree, an engineering degree, or a physics degree. So they send you this big package. And as an undergraduate, I got a math degree and a teaching degree. So I spent a lot of time tutoring my contemporaries in some of the things. But you had that. You also had the report writing, and technical report writing is its own beast altogether. So I have reports that I have in the office now because I built this test pilot course, and there's more critique than what I initially put in there, all over it. And then there's the flying, and what's going to kick your butt? It's the flying. So you're flying T-38s, T-2s, some helicopters, F-18s, things like that. And you're supposed to bring back data. Then you crunch the data, you write a report, you stand up and you give it. So it's continual evaluation and continual process. And there were some people that were there on a Friday and didn't show up on Monday. So it's really not the gentleman program. You got to be able to, pack your load. So I liked it for the technical aspect because of the math thing. There's a lot of that in fighter pilot-ish, right? If you understand all your piece of ass and maneuvering, and thank you, Colonel Boyd, things like that. Right. So I was happy to go do that. Now, I didn't want to do that the rest of my life, but I didn't know, what was going to happen or not. But I enjoyed being a test pilot. I enjoyed doing a lot of that. But I also enjoy the tactical aspect of going out and doing some type of urban renewal when needed.
Yeah, which I know you do it later on, but for your test pilot, the first assignment out, it was the ordnance officer. So I imagine, are you bringing new weapons online and testing those out on the Hornet, or what is that?
Happened was, Rain, what they didn't do was test a lot of weapons during full-scale development of the Hornet.
Okay.
Okay. So if you think now, this is 19, I get to strike in 1990, and somebody got it right because they sent me to ordnance. Now, the flying qualities of perf guy, they're like the white scarves, they're the old hands guys. They used to, and no disparity to anybody out there because I really enjoyed doing my work. The ordnance guys were kind of like the hillbillies of test pilot school, right? We were the wrench turners. We were the I had a ballistic section, but we found ourselves there, especially after the invasion, right? I was doing a lot of clearance, weapons separation, near full field effects of existing weapons, although they were old. A lot of them were coded from Vietnam, but I dropped a lot of FAE, fuel air explosive, napalm, and you can't simulate napalm because of its tumbling characteristic, right? So those were all live. Those were the two big ones. I spent a lot of time in a pool upside down in a chemical suit just in case, there were other things. So the CBRN world and flight suits and flight things, they got a lot of money to get kicked up real fast thinking that. If you look at the Gulf War Air Power Survey in the back, you'll see what was dropped and why. I think there were 628, and I could be wrong, I haven't looked at it in a while, Fay, fuel air explosives, and the overpressure was supposed to detonate the minefields. So, okay. You know, that's an open document out there, and it's in the back in the appendix. But we did a lot of that. I was on the spin team for the F-18. Do you remember seeing Chris Hadfield, Canadian astronaut, sing on the space station?
Yeah.
I got to fly with him a couple of times. I will tell you, in my mind, he's the best test pilot I ever flew with. All right. But we did the next generation of spin flights. You know, the problem with the Hornet was when it departed, it was all electric flight controls. So what they were finding is people who thought they had neutral controls, you know, and you see this in general aviation too. When you got a little stress, you push it to an appendix, right? Usually your feet. So there's always still a little rudder in there. So the next change was, you know, hey, if you depart the F-18, just take your feet off, pull power back, take your feet off, check board in, and let go of everything, right? And then watch the DDIs. You know, and the guys that flew Phantoms and the guys that flew A-7s and A-4s go, are you guys nuts? You know, so there was a little bit of institutional resistance across the board from the guys who were flying non-fully electrical flight controls. So that was kind of neat. We got to do that. But most of my work was in weapon separation and then spin. So it was all kind of Class D testing at Pax River. You got A, B, C, and D for risk. So I got my points reasonably quickly to become a member of the Society of Experimental Test Pilots.
I know Pax River, so you did have one, it sounds like a relatively scary sortie in 1992 out of Pax River in the Hornet. Is that true? You mind talking about that just a little bit?
No, I don't mind. I give briefs on it all the time that talks about crew coordination and aeronautical decision-making. I didn't sign up for it, but I guess I did if you're flying an ejection seat airplane. But I always say, you know, I didn't wake up on the 1st of October, 1992 going, hey, I'm going to have a heart attack today, or hey, I'm going to eject today and almost kill myself or be killed. What ended up happening is we were chasing. I was in a two-seat Hornet. Okay, it was a B, I think the designation. I don't think it's a D. And the officer in my back seat was a Marine Lieutenant Colonel, had been instructor of mine, and I'll say his name is it's Troy Pennington. Troy, as a captain, was prematurely gray, so you know you got two call signs with that, right? One's Gandalf, and the other was Wizard. So he's Wizard. But he was an instructor of mine as a captain when I was a first lieutenant in Beeville in A-4s. So now he's the Marine Detachment Executive Officer at Pax River, and I am the safety officer and the ordnance department head, you know. So we were chasing a foreign military sales F-18 with a young Navy lieutenant who I believe now is an admiral and was a student of mine in the war. Some 10 years, not even, not 5 years before that, okay? So if you put us in section, right, we're just chasing him around because he's doing, it's a Kuwaiti foreign military sales airplane. We kind of keep him in the restricted area, right? We watch for traffic, but we're just kind of exercising this airplane. And what ends up happening is we get a real transient inside the flight controls, coming back. The mission's done. You know, we're not even on a test sortie. The mission's done, and I'm trying to see if I have an airplane here, but I think I took it into work.
The transient, the flight controls, was that just, did you get like a bump or kind of a weird movement?
I got the rudder kicked off, and I got X's in the flight control display.
Okay.
Okay. So anyway, we take the lead. It's a straight in into Pax River on runway, I want to say 32. Yeah. Maybe not, but it's all over water. So Wizard's in the back and he says, Smash, I think we ought to declare an emergency. I go, okay, sir. You know, I mean, hell, this is 1992 when I first met him in 81, right? And I got my wing. So, and he's my XO. He's also the flight, while I'm the ordnance department head, he's the flight systems director. Okay. So we declared emergency. And it's all being, it ends up being recorded on a CD for the MIR because they had the manned flight simulator there and they took data from the wreckage. So on the way in, I'm writing down the whole flight control display page. So we do a straight in. Joe's off our left. So I'm lead. He's basically in left formation, kind of on the azimuth, right? And we put the hook down, talk to maintenance. Because if you look at earlier Hornets, they could land kind of sideways and they'd roll over because of that landing gear. So okay. I didn't want to hit. Not sure what was going on. But anyway, I get to about 100 feet and the airplane kicks off because the rudders tow in for nose pitch. And then what happened was this right rudder towed in. I didn't know it at the time, but the airplane yaws and it's on this, on like this. So I take off, I get to about 500 feet. And it's also got a flight control reset button. Now my harness is locked. So I'm resetting and I don't hear tower. I come up, the flight control's reset, much like your control out the lead on your computer. And the next thing is, they're downstairs or at work. The airplane goes knife edge. Okay. When it goes knife edge, Wizard punches us out, which means the canopy goes, the airplane pitches 15 degrees nose over, rolls inverted. He leaves at about 480 feet, hits on his heels and goes back. And by the time I leave, I get shot in the ground from 380 feet with about 80% of the chute. Break my leg, rip off my chin. For the most part, because the mass just took it off. Really hammered. Like I said, it was a pretty quick ride and a sudden stop, and I left a hell of a divot. So I tried it one October, it's like 58 degrees at 56 degrees or 3 degrees at 9:38 in the morning. So I try to stand up. I can't because my legs broke. I hear all this rustle around, so I take my helmet off and I go like this. I go, hey, I'm here. I can see where the airplane had gone in because I was reasonably close to that end, the seat. And then the next thing I know, I'm swarmed by about four or five people and they cut everything off me except my underwear. And then get my leg put in an air cast, put me on a back brace, put my neck in, and then they throw me in the ambulance and get me to the hospital. So while, you flew single seat airplane, right? And I did for the most part. This is my ejection handle with my dog tags that I never used. So the night before, we briefed that hop, and it was canceled because the airplane, the FMS airplane, wasn't ready. And the comment between Wizard and I were, because he had 100 hours in the airplane. I had 1,000. Okay. But he was also, he had done F-16N testing for the Marine Corps, right, in the adversary. And when he retired, he was the Lockmart F-16 demo pilot. Because when he got out of the Marine Corps, that's where he went. So the brief went, because I was in the front, he goes, Smash, you got 1,000 hours in the airplane. I think I had 2,200 at the time, and he probably had 3,500 as Lieutenant Colonel. I said, well, sir, I'll fly the airplane. If you don't like what's going on, get us out. Okay. So we didn't go that night. That morning, we rebriefed. Same thing. And he didn't like what went on. No time, didn't say anything. Next thing I know, because I was looking down after I reset when it went off. So we did the whole, seat thing, right? Wham, shot. So subsequent to that, I cracked 6 discs in my back, 3 in the top, 3 in the bottom. They finally got to me to Bethesda. I was in the leg cast from about the 3rd of October when they finally got to me in the surgery. And I think I got out of it about the 20th of December, 27th, when I wanted to ride home. Subsequently, it took them 10 years to realize that my left rib cage had been dislocated about a half an inch. And the scar tissue on the back finally got broken by a guy by accident who was a medical tech slash... I'm missing the word now.
like EMT?
Chiropractor okay. up in Bethesda in 2002. Okay. And people came running for that. That was so loud, it sounded like a bomb. And I'm down on the table and I hear, boom! And I go, hit! And he goes, you all right? I go, give me a minute. So anyway, and then subsequent to that, because of how I hit and some, you know, just the warranty. The warranty's done on the body. I had my whole left shoulder replaced in 2015.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health. A world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
No kidding.
Yeah. So the joke is, I mean, the joke around here outside of being the oldest instructor out there with Hilton at Piston the Jet is, you know, every time I get a new body part, I just average them all and I get younger with every surgery. So
just keep replacing it, you know?
Yeah, I just keep replacing a couple other things, you know?
From the time you had that first transient to the time you punched out, how much time do you think that was, or do you know?
I do know, because the CD that starts at about 2 miles that I have is less than 90 seconds. But what ended up happening, it was three different problems. And that was statistically insignificant when the MIR, see, I had written all that on my knee board card, all right, before I left the airplane. No one ever found my knee board, all right? So I redid my whole knee board in the emergency room in that condition I just told you, waiting for a doc to come check me out to see that I wasn't bleeding to death. So I gave my statement. Everybody didn't have cell phones then, but some of them did. And so somebody called my wife, who, you know, I've been with her since 1982 when we met and we got married in 86. You know, she's a fiery little Italian and she's a runner. So if somebody she loves is in dire straits, she gets there, you know. So they call her and they send somebody to drive her over, because we only lived about 6 miles from the base. But so I'm in the emergency room and I'm writing my statement and I'm writing out, you know, I drew the whole FCS, all the X's, all the cautions, all the blink codes. The doc, before they take my blood, says, we're going to find anything? And I go, yeah, aspirin. He goes, why do you take aspirin? I say, because the orthopedics told me to take aspirin. So they go away. She finally shows up. I mean, she's going at it. And, you know, gets in there. By that time, I see Wizard. His wife has always worked kind of where he works. He's off. I can see him to the right. He's in a wheelchair. All I could say was thank you. Yeah. You know, that was it. So she comes in. And I'll just tell two parts of this. First off, they're not going to admit me to Pax River because I don't have my ID. So they go, where's your ID? And I said, it's in my left breast pocket of my flight suit that you guys cut off and left it at the crash site. So they tell my wife to go out there and get it.
No kidding.
Well, a good friend of mine who ended up just retiring as the assistant commandant, who's now down at the Citadel, Glenn Bluto Walters, he goes to get it. And he comes back laughing because it was right where it was at. But he goes, a typical fighter pilot, he's got a quarter, a blank check, you know, because I was supposed to stop at the exchange and cash a check, right? That was Thursday. So they find my ID, you know, and then the doc shows up and he basically presses on my stomach and says, you're not bleeding to death. And I go, you know, I think this is about 11 or 12. And I said, you know, one. And then he looks at the report and he goes, you know, your cholesterol's a little high. And my wife said, isn't cholesterol related to stress? And he goes, well, yes, it is. And she goes, well, don't you think he's under some freaking stress? And that's not what she said. And so I never saw that guy again. And so then the group CO shows up, the Marine colonel, and, you know, kind of pats her and says, hey, you know, Donna, we got him now. The whole bet, we'll take care of him. She goes, that's why he's here, because you had him. So he's mine now. And she never left after that. So,
jeez,
you know, but the whole go out and get the ID thing. And but anyway, so what ends up happening is there's three problems in the airplane that we don't know about. One of them is, you know, the flight control computers are like the left side and the right side of your brain. They got four hard wires that go between them, right? Two of them were broke. And the other thing is, again, you flew an electric airplane. When you fire it up, you got an I-bit that goes through everything, right?
Yep.
Well, the fault tree logic was bad, and it was kicking it out halfway through testing the flight controls and never got to the rudder. And then with the gear down and the flaps down and the hook down, you're in a high gain, and the rudder pack failed. So all three of those basically demanded that the right rudder fare, and that caused a departure on the miss on the go around. Now, that is in all the X's and O's and blend codes that I wrote down, but they said that couldn't happen. When did he write this? And he goes, well, he wrote it in the emergency room, you know, laying on a backboard with a neck brace and a broken leg, no chin, and, you know, in his underwear. And I go, well, it's under stress, you know, we can't really. So anyway, the guys who did the MIR finally go through everything, and it takes a while, right? Because all the computers, and they print it all out, and somebody finally sees this display of the flight control page. And they go, where have we seen this before? And they go, well, Smash drew that in the emergency room. And they put them up against each other, and they were the same.
No kidding. I would imagine it's like the Viper too. It's you can display in percentages or hex code, but when you get into the bit page for the Flickus, I mean, I remember doing that for the avionics guys troubleshooting stuff, and it's ones and zeros. So that's impressive. I guess being a math major helps.
We'd get X's in a display. It's a picture, and then underneath those, it would give you a blend code of four digits, if I remember right. But you had to go through channels 1, 2, 3, and 4 to get them all, because I had X's in all the channels.
Okay.
So, yeah. So then that was, well, you know, and that's what started a big lawsuit, because the original equipment manufacturer was telling the Navy they knew what was wrong, and they told the Navy didn't fix that. So that got into the finger pointing.
Gotcha.
What I didn't tell you was the airplane augers in and kills a lady in a white truck on an access road.
Yeah.
So. But I don't find that out till Sunday, and I'm up in Bethesda. So anyway, then it becomes statistically insignificant until they start looking at those lots of airplanes, you know, with that flight control system.
Right.
And then things started changing. So, you know, while I was lucky to be alive, thanks to Wizard, because I wrestled with that for a while, that, you know, I flew a single seat airplane, but I didn't get to the handle. You know, I want to say that I compartmentalized during two briefs to say that if something was going wrong and a guy who'd been my instructor was also my XO and also senior to me would get us out. And that's what he did. So I've given that lecture I gave it to George Mason. I gave it to the Pad Cat Society of Andrews. I've been out to Reno for the Naval Aviation Ordnance Society and gave that, because they're the guys who do CAD-PAD stuff too, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's a part of the mentality that, okay, I didn't sign up for that on 1 October, but in essence, you train your life for emergencies. We're usually real good at handling the primary and maybe a secondary, but when you have tertiary and you don't see a couple of them, you know, then you might get surprised. So if you look at the ejection envelope, depending on how thick your or how well your pencil is sharpened, I'm either in, outside, or right on the line. And in fact, when I gave it to the CAD-PAD Society, there was a representative from London, for the seat manufacturer. And he said, well, I remember this. He said, when we got your accident, that's not how we modeled it.
Really?
I said, how did you model it? They go straight and level, just kind of settling at 380 feet. I said, well, you can see from the computerized video that came from data from the airplane in the manned flight simulator Pax River, that's kind of not how it happened.
Jeez.
The real interesting one out of the Miles and Babes, right? I think it was either in a garage, it was either in a grocery store or her daycare, because my daughter was born in 89, 92. So, you know, she's 2.5, 89, 90, 91, 3.5. And somebody asked about, hey, did you see what happened at the air station like a day or two later? And she goes, oh, yeah, that was my daddy. The airplane flipped upside down and he fell out.
It just fell right on out. Kids, you
know, just fell right out.
With a rocket motor strapped to you.
Oh. Yeah, shoot me in the ground. That kept me up for a long time because I remember all of it.
Was pulling the handle? Did you have time to think about that? I know that's probably what kept you up.
No, I never got to the handle. They gave it back to me with my dog tags cut out of my boots.
Yeah, but I mean, was in
Wizard. Wizard pulled, and again, I didn't think of it because I think in my mind, hopefully I compartmentalized and we briefed the night before and that night. And I just said, sure, I'll fly the airplane. If you don't like what's happening, get us out. I didn't think what was happened was going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, I've taken arrestments, ground field arrestments like that before, and you just kind of roll in the gear and you stop. That was what I thought. And in fact, when you listen to the dialogue, because they put Tower and my audio on it, one of the things the MIR and then the review said, he's as calm as he usually is. He goes, he had no idea that something was going to happen. So, I don't equate that to what Sully did by any means, but, I was a community leper till they figured out that what I had drawn was actually what had happened. And then, they had people flying test pilots flying it in the simulator. And as I understand, they all crashed, but now you're playing quick draw. You know it's coming.
Right. Yep.
Much like Sully's issue, I read to the NTSB and some of that stuff. They put those other guys in and they're making that snap decision in 12 seconds.
Right.
To make that divert. Of course you're going to make that divert, but you're also playing quick draw, right? So, we prepare a lot to handle those things. And most of my time I had flown single seat and done weapon separation and things like that. But the point really, Rain, is I was never in the operational forces in a Hornet. I went from Phantoms to being an instructor to doing some developmental training work to test pilot. And I had 1,000 hours in the Hornet and I'd never been to a VMFA squadron in Beaufort or El Toro or Miramar, soon to be, so when I left PAX, I went to be an XO in a forward deploying squadron.
How was that like? Cause most of the test pilot guys in the Air Force, once they go into the test world, they don't really leave it.
There weren't too many of us that went back and forth. And in fact, you can't now. The Navy has the AEDO program, much like you guys, aeronautical engineering duty officer. So once you become a test geek, you're in there, right?
Yeah.
I used to say, you'd spend your time out in the gun squadrons and you'd get all the patches and you'd be tactically proficient, right? You got weapons school, you got this, you got that, you got that. You go to the test community, they don't care. That's a prerequisite. But once you get there, you gotta make your bones there, right?
Yep.
So then you go back tactical and they don't care that you've been testicle. So it really doesn't make a difference. Yeah. You're always paying your dues to go back to get your MOS credibility wherever you're working. So
right.
Was I behind? Yeah. I mean, some of the operational things that Hornets were doing while the missions were close to the Phantom, they weren't the same tactics, techniques, and procedures. So, I'd been a RAG instructor. That's got nothing. you know, you're teaching young guys how to fly it. And I went from air to ground stand, low altitude tactics to air stand. And I wrote flight schedule and I was in the, I wrote a portions of a flight instructor training course because the admiral out there wanted all his guys coming out of the fleet to at least get kind of an introduction to being an instructor. So you go to Beaufort and here I am now an XO in an F-18 squadron with a skipper who was going over Baghdad night number one as an XO of another squadron with a distinguished flying cross and a combat V. So, you know, I got some catching up to do in the tactical world after being gone for 4 years.
How was it? I mean, because again, you're like you said, you're going from being a Phantom driver, obviously do the Hornet at the rag and then test pilot. But then, like you said, I mean, I was just thinking about, you know, my time. So I did 2 years as a demo pilot and the tape change from 6.2 to 7.1. which was drastically different. It also changed some of our air-to-air shot doctrine, things like that, as well as how we did seed. And for me, still flying the Viper all the time, but not doing it tactically, looking at it, I was like, this is going to be a significant challenge to get back into the fight and learn kind of the new way, let alone doing it in a different weapon system.
Yeah, I think it was that. And then I worked up and I got air combat tactics instructor called in the Hornet through MOTS as the XO. In fact, we did it at Hill.
Okay.
We deployed to Hill. We trained with those guys doing some, you know, laser quad work, flight of two Hornets, flight of two F-16s, and at the Uter. And on the side, we were getting our workups and our training for air combat tactics. So once you get that under your belt again, you know, if the guys from Yuma are coming out and evaluating you, that's your start. And then you work strike warfare because, you know, then we went to Aviano and we went into Bosnia from January of 94 through basically the 1st of May of 94. And then we came back to Beaufort. CO left in July. I'm sorry. He stayed and left in January of the next year. The new CO was in there. And in December of 2004, we were out on the ship on the USS America for our first tailored training activity. And I hadn't been on the ship since, 1981.
How? You got to qualify on the ship, right? In the rag.
Yep. Yeah, well, another major who came out of MOTS and I went back to the rag and got worked up and we went out to San Diego and we went to the Lincoln and we CQ'd at the Lincoln. And I think the week after that was when they lost the Tomcat off the back end, but that's another whole different issue. So, but I knew the big XO from the Lincoln because he was a moron. Like I was, but he was Navy. So, so that's how we CQ'd. Then we went back and then we forward deployed on the America and we went back to Bosnia and, late August of 95. And then we went into Iraq in 95 doing, expecting to worry about the Basra breakout when they were talking about that. And we came home in 96 off that deployment. So I ended up being the XO for almost two years and 2 months, I think. And then as the first port visit, the skipper came in and said, "Hey, I got a job for you." And I said, "Sorry, I already have a job." He goes, "Well, you know," he needed to move people up and rightly so. So they moved me to the air wing and I was the chief staff officer of the air wing. So they kind of made a billet because I was a senior major.
Okay. Those deployments to Bosnia and to Iraq in the mid-90s, I assume just a lot of caps?
A lot of caps. I was in Gorazda in 1994.
Okay.
We got underneath an overcast layer through the following the river after the skipper had been in there and done some work. You know, I knew your captain who ended up spending some time doing search and evasion.
Yeah.
He was up in Aviano. Yep. He was also on the Udbina shoot down, but it wasn't a really successful event for him. That was in 94 also in April, I think, maybe March. But in April, I was in Garazda, so you had some opportunity. But yeah, there was a lot of cap time.
Yeah. I mean, because you have a pretty busy, after test pilot, after Pax River, with three rounds in Bosnia, a round in Iraq, and then Iraqi freedom kicks off.
Yeah.
And that
point. Well, after the COs, after that EXO tour in 96, I come to Quantico to go to school again. So again, I had done command and staff by the external mode because I didn't think I had a chance to get there. I was pretty senior. So they sent me up there in 96. I got promoted to lieutenant colonel the 1st of October in 96. And then that same day, the monitors came down to brief the command slate. And I found out I was going back to Beaufort to take the same squadron that I was going to be I was the XO in. So 97, I leave Quantico, go back to Beaufort, and I'm the director of safety and standardization at the Marine Aircraft Group when Jim Amos was a colonel and he retired as a commandant. So that was a preface for me going back to 251, taking the CO from 98 to 2000, at which time we chopped to back to Air Wing One and we went on the USS John F. Kennedy and spent most of the time in the Gulf.
Busy time, a lot of carrier ops. I know I was just, again, looking at the bio, six different carriers, over 500 landings, 214 of them at night, all of which sounds terrifying to me. But
yeah, nobody counts those things anyway. They're just on the top of my head. But
yeah,
no, I did. I mean, if you look at the Lexington, you start as a kid, then I end up doing, I told you on the Lincoln, Carl Vincent, the John F. Kennedy, the America, and I think I snuck one or two on the Enterprise. But
yeah, quite a bit of time on the boat. And that's what, again, I don't know, I like those nice long runways.
Thing about here out teaching, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes we get some adults out here with advanced degrees who have kind of a little hubris. And they'll have a little problem in the landing pattern. And I'll go, what's the problem? The runway's not even moving.
It's stationary. You know it's there the entire time.
In typical fashion, they just go, well, you're jaded.
Your rounds. So do you go on two deployments with Iraqi Freedom, or are you just there towards the end of your career?
Well, we went over in 95 to supposedly be a tactical support or strategic support asset for Fifth Fleet, when what I think it was the three-star there at the time was worried about the Bosser breakout. So we just swung the ditch and spent about a week and change there and back. That to me was really hard because, I mean, we're getting over there, been doing a whole lot of training, a lot of wins, but so then we come back and then we come home. On the John F. Kennedy, when I was a CO, that was our primary mission. We were going to go in the Gulf, and we were there in 99 and 2000. So we got there in September and we left in March. Okay. So we were the only boat, as I understand it, that was at sea during the Y2K problem because we were a non-nuke.
Ah, interesting. That's something I never even thought about.
Yeah. And we got the Goo Goo Dolls to come out and give us a concert.
That's the simple joys, right?
Yeah, it was. I guess the kids liked it. they look at guys like me as a Marine colonel or light lieutenant colonel at the time with the rock and roll eyes, and they don't understand. I will tell you, as the DCAG on the Carl Vinson, Stephen Lang came out and did some of his work. And
yeah,
he's an amazing man.
That's awesome. Yeah. Different experience than,
So then, the Carl Vinson, I'm the DCAG now, again, on purpose, handpicked, we'll leave the analogy to you. The Carl Vinson's up in Kitsap, up by Seattle, Tacoma, right?
Yeah.
So it's going on a Around the World cruise. And then when we come home, they're going to put it in at Norfolk because they have to pull the they're going to recore the reactor and do all the systems. So they left on the Pacific coast and they came back to the Atlantic coast. So that was an interesting piece. I spent a lot of time in gutter on that one just because of the chaos, but I did get to fly a bunch of the DKAG and flew in most of the airplanes. And then I took over the air wing January of 2006, and we were supposed to go, we were going to go to John C. Stennis. So, I mean, I took over on the Midway in San Diego because the guy I took it over from at the CAG at the time, his dad had sailed on that boat.
Is that a normal thing to change out like that? Or what is that normal command?
The Navy will change out. They've gone to the fleet up program.
Okay.
The Marine Corps likes to stabilize and then deploy. The Navy's manpower model, they'll change out commands at sea. Because if they fleet up or before they were fleeting up, they'll change that command because the guy's been in the unit. He's a known entity. And then they bring in a new XO who's got to step up to the plate. But by the time you're an XO in the Navy, especially in the VFA world, you know, the Hornet world, you've been out to sea probably four times. So, you know, it's not that difficult, but we did it, you know, the Midway is a nice museum there in San Diego. They've done a really nice job with that. And we did the change of command on the bow.
That was a 6-month rotation for you for command?
Only because right after I took over in January, the 07 list came out and I was not on it. And I had to weigh a lot of personal, professional, and emotional options.
Gotcha.
It was a great opportunity, you know, getting out again. Tactically, the units do what they're supposed to do. The Navy and the Marine Corps units that I got to command and then be a part of, tactically, they answer the bill. In that position, it was, from my point of view, it was politically charged from both services.
Yeah, as I think probably a lot of people would echo those same sentiments there.
You know, when you look, I mean, I had almost 6 months as a chief staff officer, and I had a year and a half as a DKAG. So, you know, I got 2 years on air wing staff. So I only had a year on a mag staff.
Yeah.
So, but that's another whole rabbit hole to go down. But I had people stopping me at my house who knew this all happened, and I'd be mowing the lawn and they'd get out. So I'd have to stop mowing the lawn. And, you know, I'd get told how important this was to Marine Corps and in essence, don't screw it up. And so, you know, it got like that. I got a lot of attention that I thought some would come, but to be honest with you, I had to put everything together. And in fact, there's a, you know, I went to church on base. So I knew kind of everybody there, but I went out in town because we had been to the Catholic church out in town, and I spent about 3 hours on one Saturday afternoon deciding what I needed to do, and then I made the decision. So that's the reason I was in command for 6 months, because I was slated to go on another deployment on the John C. Stennis back to the Gulf, and it would have been through 07 if they let me complete the whole deployment. And I would have missed my daughter's high school graduation, and I only have one daughter. So
that's a tough sell.
And I didn't want to take a chance of being non-selected again.
Yep.
And then, you know, we'll leave it at that. I mean, there's probably 18 or 20 hours of oral history in Quantico covering this.
Yeah.
Way back when. So.
No, that story is not too uncommon, unfortunately. You know,
yeah, I mean, there's been a lot, you know, especially with, I've seen guys move around, right? Because they can get into high school or college and the athletics if they're doing that. But the social aspect of watching junior high and high school young ladies get moved because PCS or whatever, I mean, I didn't take them back to Lemoore. I geobatched. I moved out of the house,
yeah,
really to get qualled down in Oceana and come home on the weekends and maybe do a look in the Pentagon because I still had some responsibilities there. But when it was time to go to be the DKAG and You know, I'd moved out for the most part in January of 03 for training. And when I finally got boat trained in Old Bed, I ended up driving out there in 04 and stayed out there through 06. I tried to get home, but, you know, most of the time, if you're carrier deployed for 6 or 7 months, that 6 months before your deployment, you're probably gone for three of it anyway, either out to sea training or you're up at Fallon.
Yeah. You know, I mean, for, I know everyone's a little bit different, but me leaving active duty, I think was kind of a same calculus went into it. Looking at least three moves, if not four moves, maybe five in 8 years, you know, and they're not going to be necessarily the garden spots. You're going to be a geo bachelor or you're going to be moving the family, you know, like that's a tough sell. And it just, it keeps repeating.
No, you're right, Rain. And in fact, when we got married in 86, we moved to Lemoore, and believe me, my wife wasn't really happy.
Strange. I've heard nothing but great
things. My daughter was born there, but she didn't know anything because we left, put her on an airplane 2 weeks later, and we went to Pax River. Yeah. Taking her back there, she's like, Dad, how come you never got, you know, assigned to San Diego or Miramar or El Toro? You were up here. So then when the Air Wing that they slated me for, and there's another whole understory of that, is in Lemoore, Donna just looks at me and she goes, I'm not going back there. And all my daughter had to see was my wife wasn't going back there. And I go, no, there's no reason for, you know, Donna was working here as a doctor's assistant because she worked orthos and she worked derms. And my daughter was in high school, you know, and I said, no, you're not moving. And I go, do this. I'm not going to be in Lemoore anyway. So, yeah, it was. I had to make a decision between next look at 07 and another deployment. And in fact, when I didn't get selected, a contemporary did, who really had no ship time. And, you know, I just had to weigh everything, what I saw in the Marine Corps, around the Marine Corps, and what was happening inside my family.
Yep. Well, you like to retire shortly thereafter. What has retirement looked like? And I say that with air quotes because I know you're not retired. You're still active doing things. So,
I had a guy call me up about 3 months ago about the test pilot course. He was an Air Force big wing veteran who lives in outside of Charleston, South Carolina. And we got to talking because I got about 10 years in Buford on again, off again. And we really liked the low country. And his summation was, I am failing retirement miserably. But, you know, the transition, I ended up working for SAIC from 06 to 18, a couple reorgs, a couple other things. That was a good piece. I got some idea of industry, you know, granted it's a government contractor up here. That's where I met Hilton.
Okay.
And we were in the same division. So, that was good. You know, it was, never seemed to be really hard, you know. There were a lot of analytical problems, and the people that I was working with were pretty analytical, and we could solve those problems. That was always the neat thing about it. Took a couple reorgs, and by 18, I just, you know, 2018, I'd had enough of a lot of that, and decided that was it. And Mike had been yapping at me about being a flight instructor, so I did all that, and since then, for the last 3 years, I've been a flight instructor, and I'm the president of the FAA Flying Club, and, you know, on the math board at Ohio State, and then just recently, in January, I became the president of Mount Vernon MOA. So, like the guy from South Carolina said, you're failing retirement.
Just staying busy just a little bit.
Well, I started a consulting business, too, after the PhD. I had a couple contracts I was working. I took a artificial intelligence machine learning course out of MIT for strategic business application. So that worked because a lot of the industry in aviation, you know, is looking at AI ML to help maintenance material management. And instead of doing the, you know, replace when breaking, you can project the replacement or at least have an input to your logistics stream. So, you know, that was kind of neat. Made some stuff there. And but COVID kind of showed a little bit about that. But the good thing is for me, for COVID, I would just go out and social distance at 4,000 feet.
Yeah, No, not a bad way to do it.
Yeah. So when we started, you know, it's pretty neat. I'm almost going to an airport every 5 days or 6 days a week. And some people in the neighborhood go, "Hey, where are you going?" I'm going to the airport. They go, "Isn't your day off?" I go, "Yeah, I'm going to go flying." So, you know, I got a couple of club airplanes and I'm in an airplane with Hilton and a Baron owned by a third party that we fly with. And, you know, they got all school airplanes. So it's kind of neat.
To me, that sounds like winning.
I feel like I am, but, you know, I'm all kidding aside. I was telling Hiltz, I said, I think I got about 7 more months and I got to sign up for Medicare. And he just laughs. He said, "I'm a bit behind you." I go, "Yeah, about 5 years." So, you know,
Vince in.
No, it's the fact that, you know, I've been through a lot of therapy and rehab from the injuries over the years and, you know, scars and stuff like that. And there are a lot of people worse off than I am. I'm not making it sound like, you know, but, you know, I do, my wife got me involved doing Pilates, so I go once a week, and that's been really good for maneuverability, core strength, and kind of a rehab in a lot of areas. So I can see the value of that as I'm climbing in and around and up and down and over airplanes, that's for sure.
Yeah, do you have a lot of residual pain from that ejection?
I mean, it's all a matter of how loud the radios in your body get, right? I just turn the volume down. I mean, it was funny when I was getting out of the Marine Corps, right? In 06, it was after 9/11, right? About 5 years. And there was a lieutenant commander in ortho. He was supposedly big in his field. And he joined the Navy from the Bay Area. So he was working down in Balboa. So I had to go down there from a MOR to get my exit physical and get evaluated. So, you know, he had never seen a Marine colonel walk in there, you know, and so I met him, you know, he's a lieutenant commander. They made him a lieutenant commander, so that's how high he was in his field.
Yeah.
And he looked at me, he says, "You know, I know you know how to fly an airplane, but I don't know how you walked in this office." And I said, "I've been told I don't look real good on x-rays." So we got to talking about my back. I said, "My back's okay. You know, I do a lot of the basic therapy that they told me about in 91. And again, Pilates helps that now too. So, but then he looks at it and goes, "You know, you ought to get all that hardware taken out of your leg, you know, because I got a plate and 8 screws in my right leg above my ankle where I left the divot, plus my shoulder hit the other side." So, that's, you know, I had that replaced already, but that was long past. They couldn't attribute that to the accident. So he says, "You should get that taken out." And I go, "Why? It's not bothering me." He says, "Sooner or later it will." Now you got to remember that happened in 92, and now I'm talking to this guy in 06.
Yeah.
Right. So I just looked at him. I said, "You need this for your training and readiness, right? You need to do one of these." And he looked at me because I knew he was kind of new to the Navy. And I said, "Let me ask you a question." He goes, "Go ahead, Colonel." I said, "Flathead or Phillips?" He goes, "I'm not going to tell you." And I said, "Well, I'll have them both there, and I'll have a bottle of Jack Daniels and an X-Acto knife, and I'll do it myself." He goes, "You wouldn't do that, would you?" I go, "Nope, I'm not that dumb, but you're not going to touch it either."
Yeah. So
we came to that agreement, and I still have the hardware in my leg.
Gosh.
So, you know, when there's kind of a theatrics to that, right? Because you know what they expect when you walk in. So you just kind of give it. I mean, you know, on the ship, every now and then people would come barge into my office and I just go, "Stop. I want you to go outside and I want you to come back and ask me nicely. Okay. I want you to treat me with some respect." And they kind of look and they go, and they did it. It was really kind of interesting. Comic relief and theatrics. Some of that's good.
Playing the game. Well, sir, as we wrap up here, I always like to ask my guests if they found, you know, 15 or 16-year-old Smash on the street, is there any advice you would give him? Anything to change or do differently?
You know, I always wanted to play football in college. And, you know, I wanted to play where I attended. And I know you don't know how big I am or not, but So when I went down to Ohio State, I put papers to walk on with my dad when I took the tests, right? And they didn't call me, so I did it again, figuring they lost it, you know, of course, because I believed my high school coaches. You know, it's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog. But about my second year, I was working at the university, and I had about three interactions with Woody Hayes. And he liked the military, of course, and he saw me right after I got back from officer canning school. And he said, "Son, I like your haircut." I said, "Thanks, coach." And I told him a story about walking on and filling out paperwork. And he said, "What are you going to do when you graduate from Ohio State?" And I said, "Well, sir, I'm going into Marine Corps to be a fighter pilot." He goes, "That's good, because you've never had a future playing football here at Ohio State. So you can have your dreams, but don't make dreams your master, and you have to have contingency plans." And I think I did, but people always ask me too. They go, and you were very complimentary. I appreciate that. But they go, "How do you, what do you offer for your successes? You know, what do you attribute that to?" And I go, "My failures." So in 16 years old, I had my first knee surgery, and I saw a good friend of mine rip his knee up, and man, he was in pain. And, you know, you recover. So if you'd caught me at 14, you know, when I was an apple cheek jerk off, that might be different. Yeah. But I think there were some formative mentors along that path, emotional coaches, that give you an idea what leadership's about, what work ethic's about, and what success is about. And I think they put me on the right thought process. Now, I've told you about a bunch of failures or trials and tribulations. You know, I didn't know what was happening with the Harrier thing. I was going to teach math in East Carolina if I didn't have a future after that. So you got to kind of stay the course. And when you stub your toe, get up and get at it again. And I've seen a lot of type A personalities that stub their toe and the cards just come apart, you know?
Yeah.
And when I first started playing CYO football, you know, I was getting my butt kicked, and you just got to pick yourself up and go at it. So I'm happy those lessons probably came early in my life and realized that I wasn't the most gifted, the most capable. And in fact, I have a picture in the basement signed by Neil Armstrong from about 15 years ago, and he's on the moon, and he said, "You know, Major Yurovich, good luck with your quest." Signed Neil Armstrong. And I put two sets of wings, naval aviator wings, and I was already a naval aviator, and I'd applied, and I was an astronaut selectee in 91 by the Marine Corps, and then 93. But, you know, 93 was post-ejection, and they'll never tell you, but, you know, I never made that cut. I didn't have the right stuff. So what I put was an inset from Kipling's, you know, "If you can dream and not make dreams your master." And I think that poem, "If" by Kipling, was kind of a guiding piece for me. And I found that when I was 14.
Okay. So,
yeah, it was in a freshman high school English book when I went to the big public high school, because I spent 8 years in a Catholic grade school. So, you know, I think the idea is if you want something, work hard for it, go at it. Nobody's going to give you anything. And, like we prefaced when we started, I've done a lot of career days for ROTC back at Ohio State, high schools around the country, and junior highs that, you know, sometimes you just can't keep their attention. So that's the piece, is learn your lessons, learn by other people's mistakes, and try to minimize yours. And if you do, which you'll make mistakes, don't make them more than once, the same one.
Shaq. Well, sir, sage advice. I appreciate you taking the time today. Share your story. I know people are going to enjoy hearing it. I was fascinated by it. So thank you again for taking the time.
Well, Ray, I appreciate the invite. And, you know, I'll probably put more of an ear on a lot of your other work. So thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thanks for listening today. If you enjoyed today's episode, please think about swinging over to iTunes. Spend a couple seconds. Drop a rating or review. Help the show grow. If you're looking for additional content, you can swing over to patreon.com/theAfterburn podcast. Until next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.